history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you. Maybe they're down the street, maybe right next door, or maybe they gather every week at a restaurant like the Old Bold Pilots in Oceanside, California. We're going to meet a couple of these nonagenarian aviators today. The idea is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn things we really can't learn anywhere else. We're educated, entertained, and often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Now, you're going to hear the hustle and bustle of a busy restaurant today because this show is recorded at Denny's on the corner of Vista and El Camino Real in Oceanside, California, where every Wednesday morning at 7 a.m., a group called the Old Bold Pilots holds court. You'll know you found the right spot when you notice the models of the warbirds they flew decades ago hanging from the ceiling. First, we're going to hear from 94-year-old Rod Braswell, who completed 50 missions as a B-24 pilot during World War II. So when it comes to the Old Bold Pilots getting together at Denny's in Oceanside every week, do you guys ever have a contest to see who's the oldest, boldest?
We celebrate the oldest pilot here whenever we have a Christmas party, and that pilot gets to cut the cake and be served first. And that's the only time we ever do anything on who is the oldest.
And you probably have to wait a while to claim that title, huh?
Oh, yeah. There's about, I think, probably four people that are older than me. I'll be 95 this year.
Yeah, you're only 94. One of the young bucks in this group of old, bold pilots. Rod Braswell is telling his story now. You grew up in Virginia, went to high school in Washington, D.C. Let me ask you, as a young boy, I know that's a long time ago, 80 years ago we're talking or more, do you remember what some of your dreams or your ambitions or your ideas about the future were?
You know, when I was in high school, I was more interested in the ladies or the girls there at the high school for me to even know that there was a war approaching. And I graduated in 39 from the high school, and war was pretty hot in Europe at that time and getting hotter. But I didn't even know there was a war going on. I was so interested in the girls.
I guess so. And that probably didn't change at Virginia Tech.
It hasn't changed yet. I've been married three times. I'm 94 years old, and I have a girlfriend that I'm very interested in.
Aha. Uh-huh. So you're thinking about marriage number four?
You know, I talked to her about that, and she said, I said, I'd like to ask you to marry me, but before I do, I have to be assured that you'll say no. And she said, okay. So I asked her to marry me, and she said no.
I could tell this is going to be a fun interview already. So you go off to college at Virginia Tech, and I guess that's where you were on December 7th, 1941.
Actually, I just went 1 year to Virginia Tech, and then my dad was military, and he moved to California. And so I was going to a junior college up in Salinas, Monterey County, mm-hmm. when Pearl Harbor hit.
Okay.
In December of 41.
So that would be what, Hartnell? Is that the junior
yes,
college
that
up there?
Is the junior college. It was called Salinas Junior College at the time, but it is Hartnell now.
Well, and I know they're listening there on one of our affiliates, 1460 KION, that airs the show every Saturday at 3. So
really?
they'll appreciate that Salinas reference.
Uh-huh.
So what do you remember about that day in Salinas on December 7th, 1941?
It was a very notable day in as much as that my sister living in Virginia had delivered a baby a couple of 3 days before, and my mother had gone east to be with her daughter at the time. And so I did not have a mother at home. My father was home, of course. We were all wondering, where do we go from here with this big event like Pearl Harbor? My mother talked to my dad about whether she should stay with my sister or come back to be with her family, because there's so much unknown about what's going to happen now. And the decision was made that she would come back to be with her family, because my dad might be transferred somewhere like overnight. And she did come back to stay with her family on December 7th. It was about December 9th, I think, when she came back.
So, I mean, it sounds like your world was a little tumultuous at that point.
Very much so. I didn't know where I was going to be going from there either. At the time, I did have a pilot's license that the government sponsored a program for teaching people who were in college how to fly single-engine small airplanes. And I did have a private license at that time. And I thought, well, with the war heating up like it is, I guess I'm going to be in the Army Air Corps. And so that's where I went when I finished my 2 years of college.
Where did that flying bug start for you? How young were you when you thought, you know, I would love to fly?
Actually, it started before I got my license, because I was working with a fellow who had a private license, and I lived in the Monterey County, and he said he knew some girls down in Los Angeles, and he was going to go down there to see them. Would I like to go? And I'd never been to Los Angeles in my life, so I said, okay, let's go. And while we were here, we went out to a little airport that's not there anymore, but it's in East Los Angeles, and he rented a small airplane and took me up, and he did a snap roll, and he did a couple of spins, and when we got on the ground, he said, how'd you like that? And I said, I like that just fine. And he said, you could be a pilot. And that was the beginning of my flying career.
Wow. Put that thought in your head, and you ran with it.
I certainly did. Yeah, that's what happened.
You enlist in the Army Air Corps with that idea of being a pilot. And just about every Army Air Corps veteran I talked to, that's what he wanted to be, was a pilot. But a lot of them didn't end up as pilots. They're navigators, bombardiers, gunners. Were there some times where you wondered if you were cut out for this, if you were going to make it into that pilot seat?
Well, I really didn't have much doubts on the basis that I knew how to fly before I got into the Army Air Corps.
Mm-hmm.
And so I felt confident enough that I will make it all the way through. And I did, of course.
Were you thinking multi-engine, or were you one of those guys who said, man, I want to fly one of those fighters?
I didn't want fighters. I wanted a twin-engine airplane called an A-20.
Mm.
And that's a smaller airplane with a crew of three or four.
Yeah.
The pilot does fire the guns. I believe a bombardier and a gunner. There's a turret in the top, and they don't fly very high, a small crew, and they don't fly for hours. But that's not what they gave me. They gave me the four-engine bomber that flies high. It's cold up there, and along with a whole bunch of other things, and a big crew that I'm responsible for. And at 22 years old, that's a lot of responsibility for a kid my age.
Yeah, no doubt, especially for 50 missions over Europe during World War II. Where were you flying from?
My base was in Italy, and it was close to a town called Foggia. Foggia is a pretty good-sized city on the Adriatic. It was on the east side of Italy where I was based. So to get to Rome, I would have to fly due west across the country and up across the Mediterranean, and then turn inland to Rome where the target was. That was the first mission. Most missions went east, though, to the Balkans, over to Ploiesti and Romania, and some missions into Vienna and the other countries in that area.
You just said the P word, Ploiesti. It's infamous
for
bomber pilots and bomber crews during World War II. The first raid there was about as devastating a mission as American bombers flew during World War II, with so many planes shot down. You weren't on the first one, but you were on the second, third, and fourth Ploiesti raid.
Well, they say that more than 50% of their oil came out of Ploiesti for Hitler's war machine. And we used to call Ploiesti Hitler's gas station.
Uh-huh.
He depended on Ploiesti so heavily for the fuel.
So when you find out that that's your target, I'm sure you know how many American planes were shot down the first time they went after Ploiesti, right?
Yes, I did know.
Was that a little intimidating to find out that's where we're going?
Definitely. In fact, let me tell you that when I speak to a lot of groups, and I do, the question that they ask the most is, well, weren't you scared? And my answer is always, yes, I was scared, but I volunteered for this job, and I have to do the best I can. So I was scared.
So give us a sense of what that was like, what you encountered on those Ploiesti missions.
When you don't rate very high on the pecking order, my airplane never was scheduled to fly up close to the front. So as I'm approaching the target with some several hundred airplanes up ahead of me that I can see, and I can see all that flak coming from the ground and bursting in the air, where the sky is almost black from those shells breaking, and I know that my turn to go through that is coming. Not there yet, but my turn is coming to go through what I can see up there. And that's pretty much devastating to see that kind of a situation that you have to look forward to.
You're seeing the black puffs of smoke, and then you're seeing the planes getting rattled by it.
Well,
and damaged, right?
Damaged and falling out of the sky.
Mm-hmm.
I watched my buddies fall out of the sky when it was my turn to go through that flak like that.
So I
always got hit every time I'd go, so you never knew.
Can you give us a sense of what that feels like? I mean, and it's you and a 10-man crew?
Yes, 10-man. Well, we're flying high at 25,000 feet, and it's probably about 35 degrees below zero. We have to wear oxygen masks at that altitude. and the condensation from the breathing is freezing around your neck and forming ice. I have a flak suit, which amounts to a cloth suit with the metal in the front to protect you from the shells, but nothing in the back because the pilots have armor plate in back of them. So with the heavy weight from the metal tugging on the front and nothing in the back of this canvas suit, that it's cutting your neck where the suit cuts is joined at the top. Your neck is being cut by that suit. You got ice on your neck. It's 35 below, and you got a helmet that was given to the doughboys up in the front lines that does not provide for earphones, and I have to wear that helmet to protect me, and my ears are being crushed. I'm cold, and I'm being shot at.
Sounds like a picnic.
Yeah.
What do you do in those moments? Do you close your eyes and clench your teeth? What do you do?
Well, at 22, you don't do things like that. You just think that this is not your turn. You hope anyway. And do the job that you volunteered for.
So those Ploesti missions, obviously a heavily defended target. You're getting shot up by flak every single time. In all 50 of your missions, how frequent would you say that flak was? Was it an ever-present danger and threat to you?
Well, I told you we didn't see any flak on the first mission into Rome, but the rest of them all had flak everywhere I went after that. There was damage to my plane. Some shells would break below the plane and push my airplane up in the air, and sometimes they would go right through the plane without exploding and explode above the plane. So you just never knew what was going to happen with that flak. And every time I went, I had damage to the plane. And when they patched the holes in the plane, sometimes the holes weren't much bigger than a baseball. And when they patched them, they would use the unpainted aluminum, bright colored aluminum. And my plane was OD colored, the OD paint.
That's olive drab, OD. Right?
Yeah, olive drab.
Uh-huh.
And so my plane was really ugly with all those patches on it. It had so many patches on it, it almost looked like silver instead of the olive drab color.
As long as it brings you home, right?
Yeah. Well, it didn't always do that. I went through three airplanes. One time I was over France coming south off the target. When I hit the coast, I only had two engines on one side that would work. That means I'm not going to make it back to base. So it's decision time. The planes cannot hold altitude at level flight, so we're going down at all times, meaning you need to make a decision. And the navigator said that our choices are to set down in the water, which is not a very good choice. Another one is to land in Switzerland, which is neutral, and you would be interned for the rest of the war to never fly or fight again. And the third choice would be to go into Corsica, where we have a B-25 field. And if you go into Corsica, you will live to fight again. And I polled the crew. I asked everyone on the crew, which way do you want to go? I got only one answer from 10 different men. Let's go to Corsica so we can live to fly and fight again. And I thought that's one of the reasons we're called the greatest generation, is because of 10 men want to fly and fight again.
Well said. But easier said than done, landing a crippled B-24 on Corsica. You said you only had two engines working. That's only half of what you're used to.
Let me tell you that when you have two engines out on one side, it takes two pilots to stand on one rudder to keep it straight. So you've got to coordinate as you're coming in on the approach to land to back off together on that one rudder to keep the plane straight. So it's not easy to land a plane with two engines out on one side. Very difficult.
So how did that landing materialize?
Well, I'm surprised how well it went. I had no idea it was going to go that well. So there's no way to taxi after you get on the ground with two engines out on one side. So it was a matter of just parking the airplane down at the end of the runway and let them pull it off the runway. And I was picked up. The crew was picked up that night so that we could fly again.
And he would fly again and again. Time for our first break now, but when we come back, more from Rod Braswell's 50 missions as a B-24 pilot, including the time a shell exploded right in the nose of his bomber. We're also going to meet the Flying Greek, a fighter pilot who became a double ace in the skies over Europe. Find photos of both of our guests at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook, and we'll be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country, and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and three locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.